My guest today for the Roundhouse Making Space podcast is the poet, novelist, and former Young People's Laureate for London, Cecilia Knapp. Multi-award winning, I've known Cecilia for 15 years, and I have been delighted to see her perform, lead the Roundhouse Poetry Collective, and grow to be one of the UK's most loved and admired writers. Kay Tempest said of her, "Cecilia is a great writer. I love her." I agree. Welcome, Cecilia, and thank you for joining me.
Wow, thank you for that lovely introduction, Marcus. I'm blushing.
I wanted to start by asking you, actually, maybe quite a difficult question, but as you think about poetry, probably most of the day, or lots of the day anyway, what is poetry?
What is poetry? Wow. Okay, we're starting off strong.
Starting off straight in there.
With a belter of a question. I'm sure that everyone has their own unique definition for what poetry is to them. And some people talk about poetry in kind of technical terms. You know, a poem is a piece of writing. Some people say a poem is a piece of writing where the line cuts off before it reaches the end of the page. But for me, it's more of an emotional thing. I think a poem is a way of conveying something that is often very complex or slippery to convey. And for me, poetry is a language that we have kind of all built together in order to fill in where our everyday language is insubstantial, if that makes sense, you know? And it's a way of communicating something in this completely unique, distilled way that kind of cuts directly to the heart and manages to say often what is unsayable. Because in a poem, you can do all sorts of things. You can, you know, you're not bound by the logic of a normal sentence. You're not bound by the logic of fact, and you're not even bound by the rules of grammar a lot of the time. You're not bound by reality a lot of the time. You know, you can dream and you can remember and you can put odd things together, and it creates this kind of alchemy in which we translate our feelings to other humans, and that's, you know, that's quite magic. So that's what poetry is to me. That's a long-winded way of saying it.
I don't think it is, because I think you described absolutely that it's something that normal language, normal ways of communication doesn't allow us to make those communications. So the Poetry Slam final at the Roundhouse the other night, I gave a little speech, and I was talking about the Artemis II space mission, and that the astronauts on board of that, you know, so courageous, so brave, so extraordinary. But there wasn't a moment of poetry in it. It was, you know, like the first one when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, you know, one small step for man, one giant step for mankind. And it was like that was a line of poetry. And I couldn't grasp the extraordinary depth of what they've achieved through just a few pictures, because anyone can make those kind of pictures now. I wanted something that was going to reach into my soul and pull it out a bit. And I think you've described that beautifully. Can you remember, I mean, poetry is a really powerful thing. It speaks directly to you. Can you remember the first poem you ever heard or first poem you ever read? And you went, oh, that's interesting. That speaks to me.
I did read a lot as a child, and I remember really enjoying the work of Benjamin Zephaniah. I always had a book as a kid, basically, and I was, you know, obsessed with Jacqueline Wilson and things like that. Like when a lot of kids were, who grew up in the 90s like I did. And I really remember any story, whether it was in a poem or a longer book, a novel like Jacqueline Wilson books, anything that had this kind of human story to it about someone else's experience, I always felt really, really drawn to that and wanted to know more. But then when I got a bit older and started studying poetry in a more kind of intentional way at A level and then later on university, I loved reading Dylan Thomas's poems.
Ooh, wonderful.
And I remember this amazing John Donne poem called The Sun Rising that I did at university. But that all felt very kind of in the past, if you see what I mean. And it wasn't until I actually encountered the Roundhouse that I sort of started to realise that poetry was happening now, and poetry wasn't just something that you read and studied from a different time. It was actually very much alive and happening in the very moment in the UK and all over the world. And that's when you mentioned Kay in your introduction, and that's when I started to find the work of sort of contemporary poets like Kay Tempest and started to get involved in the London poetry scene as it was happening in sort of from about 2010 onwards.
Well, Kay is an extraordinary poet and musician. It's interesting you mentioned Benjamin Zephaniah, because he was actually was the first poet that I really liked. I think all those older poets kind of just turn me off poetry, the page poets. And then I think it's Benjamin Zephaniah brought me into page poetry through spoken word poetry. I'm just wondering, when you were a kid, because not every kid was a poet in the 20 years ago, and actually quite often you're the geeky kid. Were you the geeky kid who liked to obsess around poetry?
I was a geek at school, yeah. I was called a boffin. That was the insult du jour when I was growing up, because I didn't enjoy your maths, your science, things like that, but I did love English and I loved creative writing. And I used to write a lot of stories. I spent a lot of time on my own as a kid and I would just write. And I wrote a poem at school. This is actually, you've just reminded me, I wrote a poem at school. I must have still been in primary school, I think maybe year six. We had to write a poem and enter it into a competition. And I wrote a poem about the problem of litter around my school. I think it was called Don't Be a Litter Bug or something. So yeah, I don't know if that one went down well with my peers. That's quite a geeky thing to do, isn't it? Like poetry with a admonishing tone written by a 10-year-old or whatever.
My kids, when they asked me to make up stories, so I was quite good at making up stories with them. And then in the end, they would say, don't tell us a moralising story.
I suppose it's quite a freaky thing for a 10-year-old kid to do, to write a kind of moralising poem. But then, hey, that was what I was into. I think I won a competition. I think I won the competition.
Quite right,
poem,
too.
Actually.
I'm sure you did. Started the many awards that you got later. Was there somebody who inspired and nurtured your talent when you were a kid?
My dad's a singer. My dad's a musician. And he is also a big dreamer and a big optimist. And I think that's probably had an effect on me. The sense that I could embark upon a creative career. Although he did encourage me not to. I think he wanted me to be a teacher or something, because I think he probably knew firsthand that the arts are like quite a precarious career to pursue, and there's not a lot of security, and certainly in lots of ways it's not very lucrative. So I think I used to want to act, and I wanted to go to drama school, and he really encouraged me to go and study English actually. And maybe he saw something in me that I didn't see in myself then, which was this love of words, because, you know, I wasn't self-aware enough back then to even really know that I loved stories and words and that I was affected deeply by these things. They were just sort of part of my life. Maybe he saw that in me and encouraged me to go and do it, or maybe he just wanted me to have a kind of sensible qualification. I don't know.
Never works though, does it, if a parent sort of goes, you must do this.
Yeah. I mean, it did work in this case, because I did go and do English at uni, and lots of that was really transformational, you know. There's been lots of sliding doors moments in my life, one of which was probably going to Goldsmiths to study English, which led to all sorts of other chain reactions that got me here. And I cannot think of anything worse than being an actor, quite honestly. So I'm really glad that I didn't pursue that, because I don't think I would have been very good, and I don't think it would have suited me at all. So, yeah, I'm glad that didn't happen.
Well, thankfully for us, you are doing what you do today, because you bring a huge amount of meaning to so many of us. But you mentioned storytelling, and the last person I was interviewing for part of this Making Space podcast series was Daniel Kaluuya, who is the Associate Artistic Director of the Roundhouse, but he's also an Oscar-winning actor and so on and so forth. But he talked about story being the central thing, and everyone else is there to help the story, is to facilitate the story, whether it's me in my role or whether it's the technicians, the front of house, everybody for a play or for a film or anything else. It's all about the story. And I was interested that you mentioned the story then. Could you talk about poetry being about feeling, but in your novels and in your other work, is story, in your plays, of course, story is really, really at the forefront. What does story mean to you?
I think story is the way that we understand the world. It's the way to write your own stories, to understand yourself or to confront yourself, I think. And to read another person's story is to participate in an act of empathy. So I think story is hugely important. And for me, that's how I think. I think about the world in terms of story, in terms of my experience, other people's experience. I can communicate an idea much better through telling a story than I can writing a piece of nonfiction or an essay or putting an argument across in any different kind of terms. So I think for me, story is the heart of it all as well. I think what Daniel said is spot on. And of course, story is a hugely important thing in what I put out into the world in terms of my own creative work. But I talk about story in my teaching as well, and how teaching is really about facilitating other stories. And we need more stories in the world. I always say to my students when I go and do like a talk in a secondary school, I tell them this quote from Steve McQueen, the film director. He says, "We can only learn about the world if we look through the eyes of everyone concerned."
Mm.
By which he means, you know, we need a wide range and an honest range of stories in the world in order for us to be able to value and understand each other. So, yeah, story's everything, I guess.
I could listen to you forever, but could we turn to your poetry for a second? Because you've written a lot of poems, and this book of poems called Peach Pig, which I read often, has a series of four poems in it, and you very kindly agreed to read them throughout this podcast. And the first one of the seascape poems, would you mind, could you read that to us now?
Sure. So this is Seascape, which is part of a series of seascape poems in Peach Pig. Seascape. The mist hangs its low grey breasts. A pit bull scoffs up pebbles. The man in the shrimp shack sits like a joke. How many women have run from their homes to the sea? How long will I be in the lung of this town? All my clothes are stained. A Foster's can hurls itself into the water.
Thank you. Cecilia Knapp reading Seascape from her book Peach Pig. I don't want to go into an analysis of any of your poems because I think it's up to the reader or the listener to do that. But I want to ask you, I've got so many more questions to ask you. About 10 years ago, I think you gave a TEDx talk on why you should write, which I think is just a fabulous title. I think it's been viewed over 100,000 times. And
wow.
Something.
I didn't know that.
There you go. I think it's really a powerful anthem for the importance of creativity, really. But it's also about loss and belonging. And I was deeply moved by the poem about your brother. And a line in it struck me, which was, "Words fail me, so I just carry you with me." And I'll just say that again. "Words fail me, so I just carry you with me." And I said that twice because, as a writer, when words fail you, it's something about carrying that person with you. And I just wondered if sometimes your brother's voice comes out in your writing.
It's a beautiful question. I think the question really is about a person's poetic voice and how you choose to express what you feel you need to express. And I think when I first started writing, as with all young writers, I was imitating. I was listening to the old school poets that I'd studied at uni. I was listening to the new poets that I discovered. I was doing a lot of absorbing. And it wasn't until I wrote Peach Pig that I really kind of gave myself permission to write like Cecilia Knapp poems, really, rather than a little sprinkle of this and a little sprinkle of that. And I can almost remember the moment it clicked into place. And I said to myself kind of internally, you're allowed to write about whatever you want to and whatever compels you in the voice that you want to write in on your own terms, you know. And if that means sometimes being funny, and if that means sometimes being dark, and if that means talking about things that feel really raw but also really important, like my brother's suicide, for example, then you have to give yourself permission to do that in a way that feels satisfying and authentic, to use a very overused word, to you. And I think, you know, that's why I was so inspired by poets like Kay and poets like Benjamin Zephaniah and poets that felt incredibly dynamic. It's because it felt like they were doing things entirely on their own terms, you know, without worrying what a poem should sound like or how other people might judge or perceive their poems. And to circle it back to your question, my brother was completely his own person, and a real kind of such a plethora of different things, you know. And he was very naughty and cheeky and risky. And sometimes when I was writing Peach Pig, the latter half of the book is all about him and that particular loss, really, which I think is a very difficult type of loss to write about. I did feel him sometimes on my shoulder, pushing me to say a little bit more, or to write with a little bit more courage and not worry about what other people might think or whether it was poetic enough or how it might be perceived. So in that sense, I think I do carry him with me, and his bravery and his the way that he lived hopefully comes out, especially in the poems about him. You know, because grief is a very, it's not often a beautiful thing. It can be mundane and it can be surreal and it can be funny sometimes. And so when I was writing about that, I knew he would want me to write in those terms, in those kind of honest terms about what it is actually like to lose your big brother, you know. So yes, I think I carry him with me in that sense.
I think that's beautifully said. And it reminds me, actually, if I can be personal about me for a second, is that on the other side, my grandfather lived to nearly 103. And I think he kind of survived through determination, because so many of his family are wiped out during the Second World War. And that you do carry your family with you, and it comes out in so many different ways. But your poems are, as you say, they are deeply emotional, but they're cheeky and they are naughty, and then there's a love of life in them as well. You support, for the love of life, you support charities like Calm, and you talk about loss and grief and belonging, and you encourage others to do so as well. Are you seeing a change in society, do you think? Are we becoming more open in this country?
I spend my time with writers or aspiring writers in the form of my students. So actually, I feel like I surround myself with people who very much wear their heart on their sleeves, which is lovely. What a wonderful honour to spend my time with people like that. But I've been working with Calm since my brother died in 2012, so a long time now. I think we are growing in awareness, and we're growing in our ability to kind of find the language to talk about it. Where I think we are probably still lacking massively is actually infrastructure and robust support to kind of meet that need. Because it's one thing telling people, you've got to open up, mental health should be talked about more openly and freely. But if you don't have the support in schools, and if you don't have the support for people that are actually reaching out, then what you're doing is you're asking people to open up to what? To nothing, really, and to not be able to find the support or the resources that they need, you know.
Well, resources are few and far between in so many different areas in our society. Society has been diminished.
Well, exactly, and it's not even just the mental health support that's lacking, it's the other things that are earlier interventions. So libraries, youth centres, places where people can go and be and find community and find networks. And if we don't have that, where do people go? Those places are things that do prevent people from reaching point of crisis in a lot of cases. So I feel like we're going forward in one way, but I feel like, as with a lot of things in our world at the moment, we're going backwards as well, which feels sad and preventable, you know.
You started talking about something I was going to ask you about. So I just wonder if have a little conversation about this and then go on to the second part of the poem, the seascape poems. You talked about youth clubs and we talking about society. You talked about places for young people to go. We at the Roundhouse, of course, about nurturing creativity, imagination through participation in the art. But we had this huge thing landing on our plate at the moment, which is artificial intelligence. And, you know, you talked about authenticity. And how can we be authentic or ourselves when we can quickly go online and find that actually somebody can write a poem pretty well, which is just an AI? And I think that does come back to authenticity and about our humanity. So have you tinkered with AI? And do you think this is a benefit? Do you think this is going to be fun and joyful? Or do you think this is going to be just one of those changes? Or do you think it's a hope for humanity? Or do you think it's something that we're going to have to be really careful about?
I don't like it.
is
the simplest answer for a number of reasons, one of which you've already expressed, which is that there are going to start being creative works created by AI. And I think I share your opinion, which is that that just feels so bleak to me. Because like we talked about earlier, when we were talking about story, you know, communicating your real experience in your own unique way from one human to another is such a beautiful gift. And it's utterly original. But AI isn't original. It's an amalgamation of everything that's already been said or expressed and put on the internet. Or even, you know, that they're using people's novels to train AI without their permission and without compensating them as well. So not only is it stealing original work, it's also just a kind of amalgamating it and offering it up as a piece of art. But I would argue that it's not really, because there hasn't been all that wonderful kind of thorny reflection, expression that leads to that kind of communication of an idea or of an experience. And I say this to, so sometimes I go and do poetry workshops in secondary schools, and the kids, if they have access to a computer, you know, they're often very tempted to just produce something using an AI platform. And we talk about how they haven't had that process of thought, of deep thought and inner reflection that happens when you write something. But they're so geared towards product, because the way that we educate young people is write this essay, then pass this exam. Regardless of the process that it took you to get there, that's the outcome. So they're so kind of outcome orientated. So no, I'm kind of freaked out by AI. And then that's before I've even mentioned the kind of devastating environmental impact it's having. And I think there are obviously ways that it can be used really incredibly. You know, I've heard some really encouraging, even just anecdotally, I've heard some really encouraging stories about how it can be used for early diagnosis of medical conditions and things like that. Obviously, that's brilliant. But when it comes to poems and novels, and I don't know, it's not real, is it? It's not a real piece of art from one soul to another, surely.
Let's go to some real art then. Seascape poem number 2. And in this, you do mention children as well. And in a very different way. So can I hand over to Cecilia to do Seascape poem number 2?
Seascape. School kids, fingers inside each other. Sub of the day, a Velcro wallet. Staying up late, getting damp in their cheap polos. Chatting on pebbles till the water is black.
It's really beautiful. And I know exactly where you are. On Brighton Beach.
That's right.
I know those pebbles, and I've sat there until the water is black. It's very emotional. Thank you. So, in terms of writing, Do you have to be in a kind of specific state of mind? I mean, Andrew Motion talked about having a Lem sip to take him into this kind of eerie space. Or several chefs I've heard saying that if they make a meal for someone when they're in a bad mood, it always turns out badly. Do you have to kind of meditate or go to a cafe for hustle and bustle? Or do you have a really quiet space? And if there's any noise whatsoever, then you get distracted. Or do you have music on in the background?
It's changing. I have a tiny baby at the moment, so any writing that I'm doing is in snatched moments on my iPhone in the Notes app. However, I feel that that is quite conducive to creating ideas for me, because it means that you're not overthinking things. And I think overthinking poems is the best way to kill them, because I know everybody writes differently, but for me, if I set out to write a poem with a really rigid idea in mind, I'm going to communicate this idea through this poem, then I've already kind of squashed the magic out of it. I need to be in quite a loose mindset to write a poem. And that's why, even before I had a baby, writing on buses or public transport was often really good. Or sometimes I'd go to a poetry night and then I would just scribble loads of ideas down afterwards on the way home. Yeah, always kind of not really overthinking it, being in a kind of elastic state. So cafe is also really good as well. You mentioned cafes.
You're like a magpie. Do you hear a word and sort of go, oh, that's a good word? And my son and I were once on a train and we heard two little kids talking to each other. One says, "We had pizza," and the other one went, "Wonderful stuff."
<That's>
and
so
we often
cute.
Say that, wonderful stuff.
Yeah, there's a poet called John Ashbery who used to write with the television on or the window open because of those wonderful kind of snatches of what's called found material. And I do an exercise with my students sometimes where I get them to just write stream of consciousness, but I just throw words at them like plum or mother or mayonnaise, and whatever they're writing, they have to just incorporate it into their work, because it kind of it forces new pathways. So yeah, that for poetry. But when I'm writing novels, I have to be very focused, very quiet, and concentrate a lot. I don't know why they're so different. I think probably because a novel has slightly more, I feel like a novel maybe has slightly more rules to it. You're thinking about plot and how it kind of fits together, whereas in a poem, my poems, they don't tend to be narrative or have any kind of causality to them. A lot of the time they can just be a series of images that are kind of happening in a place. There is a kind of elasticity to writing like that, which a hurry little writing session on your phone Notes app, that lends itself to those kind of poems. Whereas with a novel, I'm thinking, hang on a minute, I just said it was Tuesday, but now I've just said that it's Thursday. I've got to go back and read that chapter again and remember where exactly I am and how we're going to get to this next bit. And it's just denser. There's more words. So I need more focus and concentration when I'm doing my novels.
You've written books of poems, plays, Finding Home, Losing the Night, the novels, Little Boxes, and I want to talk about Lack, which is coming out soon. You're a broadcaster, a workshop leader, a performer. But you came to the Roundhouse as a teenager in 2011?
Yes, I was 18.
18, 2011. Yeah. Can you describe your first visit? What brought you to the Roundhouse?
I was looking for community. I was very lonely. I'd moved to London from Brighton and I was enjoying university. I mentioned earlier I'm a bit of a geek, so I enjoyed studying. But I hadn't met anyone, I hadn't made any friends really. My university experience was very much like you go to your lectures, you go to your seminars, and you only have about between 4 and 8 hours of those a week. So in between all of that, I thought, what am I going to do? I've got no money. And I saw a poster on the back of a toilet door that said drama workshops were happening at the Roundhouse, specifically a Shakespeare workshop, I think it was. I thought that looked fun, but then there wasn't any spaces or something, so I ended up going to a spoken word workshop instead, run by Polar Bear, amazing writer Polar Bear, Stephen Camden.
Yeah,
is the other name that he goes by, and I just loved it. It was amazing. We sat in a circle. he chucked beginnings of sentences at us and just said, write and don't think about it too much. And then we all read out what we'd written, and some people's was really hilarious. Jack Rook was in that particular cohort, who is now a television writer and a comedian, you know, BAFTA winner and brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man. And
good friend of yours and mine.
And good friend of mine. Yeah. I was going to say godfather to my son, actually.
Oh.
So he was in that cohort and he wrote something hilarious. And then another brilliant poet called Jess Green, who wrote something that was deeply political, but in like a totally accessible way. And I can't remember what I wrote. I think I was in a crappy relationship at the time, so I think I probably wrote something about that. Anyway, that was the Roundhouse Poetry Collective. That's what it looked like at the time. There was quite a small amount of us, and it was a year-long course where we met every Sunday for 3 hours and just kind of wrote together and went on various trips together to other poetry nights around London, and we even took a show to the Edinburgh Festival. You know, it was totally transformational. That's the pivotal moment of my life. I never considered poetry as a career, and poetry as a career led to novel writing as a career as well, and teaching as a career. So everything hinges on that moment, and it was just by chance that I saw that poster on the back of the door about the workshop.
It's actually very, very moving to hear about that. And it was the start of a journey at the Roundhouse, which continues today. You then, I think you became a trainee working in the office.
Yeah.
You became one of our young trustees.
Yeah.
I think we've produced or presented at least one, both of your plays, maybe.
Both of my plays. I've only ever written two plays, and both of them were kind of developed with support from the Roundhouse and then opened at the Roundhouse before doing tours around the UK.
Being a young trustee, you applied. I remember interviewing you, and I think it was me and Baroness McIntosh doing the interviews.
Yeah.
And what was it like to suddenly become a trustee of the Roundhouse? You know, how did it feel? And what did you think you were going to be doing? What was it actually like? I mean, you can be really honest. I mean, you can say it was absolutely terrible if you want, but I mean, you were absolutely brilliant at doing it.
It was fascinating. I don't think I knew what a board was until I joined a board. I didn't realise that every organisation has a board, and it's kind of comprised of these interesting people that all do very different things. It was just, you know, I'm a curious person. I'm always looking for experiences, and I think that was one of them. I found it really fascinating, to be honest. I've always loved the Roundhouse. It feels like a home for me. It felt welcoming as well. You know, it didn't feel scary. Everyone was really interested in the fact that in this idea of having young people on the board, and everyone was very kind of receptive and welcoming. And yeah, it was fascinating. I think that's the main thing I remember thinking. I remember really enjoying the meetings.
And your journey at the Roundhouse continues. I mean, you also run the Roundhouse Poetry Collective and have been doing that job now for 7 years on top of everything else you do. You describe little about what the Poetry Collective does, but many of the household names, the names that are known in the poetry world, have come through that collective, and many of your students that you've had as part of the collective are now going on and doing very well in slams and becoming published as well.
Yeah. I mean, in lots of ways, I think all poetry should be performance poetry, because something incredible happens when you hear a poem out loud in a room. You know, and that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone has to be a spoken word performer, because that feels like a beautiful genre under the big umbrella of poetry, and not everyone sits within that genre. But I do think that everyone can learn how to convey their poem in a kind of performed way, in a way that suits them and that works with their writing. So we do encourage in the Roundhouse Collective, we do various kind of performance workshops throughout the year. And we all sit around the table and we do various different exercises. And then we share our work and we feedback on each other's work. And we tend to look at something different each week. So we might look at voice. We talked about voice earlier in this podcast, right? How do we find our voice and be confident in our voice. And so we'll look at a bunch of different poems that show a really strong example of voice. Often we'll look at poets like the absolutely brilliant Boyega Odabanjo, or we'll look at a lot of previous Roundhouse Collective participants or Roundhouse Slam participants like Kareem Parkins Brown, for example. You know, people that have amazing, unique poetics that they've developed on their own that feel totally true to them. So we might look at that one week. The next week we might look at what is a sonnet and how can we write sonnets that feel contemporary and true to us, even though they are a very old and much revered poetic form. So we tend to look at something different each week. We keep it very low pressure. We keep it very encouraging of each other. We try to be a collective. And like you say, a lot of the previous cohorts have gone on to do some amazing stuff. I'm so proud of them. And it's one of the absolute highlights of my career is running that collective, especially because that's where I started.
But there is a vast inequity in this because it's only for younger people. I wish I could do
25
it.
25 is the cutoff.
You need people of my age to be able to do it. And I'd just say again, if Joel Taylor, Toby Campion, Boyega Odabanjo and Kareem Perkins Brown, they're all amazing poets. And, you know, you and I got to know all of them. And, you know, Boyega came up into the Roundhouse and had this very special voice and we miss him extraordinarily. But I'm going to turn back to poetry now. We're talking a lot about poetry, but we're going to talk about some other things as well. Can you read your third in the Seascape poems of four?
Sure thing. Seascape. My brother talks knee-deep with the sea. I pull him out. We twitch like fish. How many times has it taken a body beneath its softness?
Thank you, Cecilia. Now then, I've asked each of my podcast guests so far on this Making Space podcast about where do they go to when they close their eyes. And now, at the moment, when you close your eyes, it's probably a scream of a baby.
But when I close my eyes now, if my baby's not crying, I'm zonked out because I'm exhausted all times.
Of course.
But if I'm really honest, I would love it if I could say I think about redwood trees tickling the sky. But actually, I'm probably thinking about things that I've said that day that are embarrassing in hindsight, to be honest, or things that I've got to do tomorrow. Yeah, I'm sort of probably assembling a list of things to do in my head. Or I'm terrible for getting songs stuck in my head. So sometimes there'll be a song going round and round and round. Or even like something that I've heard that day in a song or on the telly or something like that. I've got a busy mind.
Yes.
When I was pregnant, actually, I started doing a daily 10-minute meditation and I found that was amazing. I don't have time to do that right now, but something that I'll probably revisit.
I was reading something of yours recently, or maybe it was a video, and you said, I sometimes sit on buses with no destination. And I was just wondering, do you actually do that? Or is that something in your mind to help you with your thinking and your creativity? What happens then? What happens when you're on a bus with no destination?
Probably that was a bit of poetic license. I don't think I've ever sat on a bus with no destination, but I've certainly sat on a lot of buses. And I always get the feeling when I'm on a journey anywhere, whether that's in the car or on a train or on a bus, I get to the point where the journey is ended and I don't want it to stop because I like being in transit. So probably I was writing around that idea when I wrote that line, which I don't even remember what that's from. But I'll take your word for it that I must have written it.
I think it might have been on one of the videos that I've seen of yours. Yeah.
It rings a bell for sure. Like, I'm a deep thinker. I'm a philosophical person. So there's always something ticking over in my head. And so I guess when I wrote that line, I was probably thinking about finding the space and the time and the place to just ruminate. And buses are, I guess, a really good place to do that.
Ruminate is a great word. And I often sit in my office up in the metal container building that is our block of offices here. And I look out of the window and sometimes people come in and say, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking out of the window. And they sort of look at me as if this is a sin. And I think this is a really important thing to do because it lets your brain do its thing, really, yeah. and come up with the thing that it's supposed to be doing rather than you forcing it to do something that it's not supposed to be doing. And I think that's Completely. When the light comes in. So yeah. I'm going to jump into the last of the four seascape poems, if you wouldn't mind.
Seascape. I put my ear to the sea. Ring, ring, the sea answers. Hello, you small idiot. Just for the fun of it, I ask if I could drink my brother's ashes back.
In this series of poems, you're dealing with some really big, really big thoughts, apart from the grittiness of Brighton, which many of us experienced, but it's guttural and it's deeply emotional and sad. The loss of your brother, of course, but it's also about art in a, you know, you're using art to convey something that is almost uncommunicable because these things are uncommunicable. You live those emotions on your own. You know, however much you talk to other people, they're still your own and somebody will listen and they'll walk away, but you are left with them yourself. It's like art as well. It's how art isn't there as therapy. Art is there for, yes, it can be used as therapy, but it's there to pull us apart and put us back together and show us something we didn't see before. It kind of is a hand going inside your chest, pulling out your heart and holding it up and letting you see it and putting it back in a different kind of way. You make art that is, they're just words on a page, but they're really heartfelt and meaning. When you talk about being a thinker, you can see that you thought about the words, but are they there waiting to be curated, or do you have a list of words that you're going to go, oh, I'm going to get these ones in? How does that work? Because it has, your poetry has a really big effect on me, and I know it has a big effect on others as well. So in that concept of art, which it does something to you much more than entertainment, how do you actually go and make it?
Yeah, what an amazing question. I don't set out with a plan ever. There's a poet that I love called Mary Ruffel, and she says, if you have an exact grid of intent for a poem, then you're standing at the top of a cliff that you haven't yet climbed. So for me, it's the climb that's the most exciting thing. And I think sometimes an image will hit me, you know, like a Foster's can hurling itself into the water, like in those seascapes. Sometimes a word will be circulating around my head that I'll want to use in a sentence. The word gubbins kept coming to me recently. I just think that's so amazing and playful. So I think, like I said earlier about inviting yourself to be in that kind of elastic state and just plucking at anything that's coming in is a really good way to begin what you need to write a poem. So sometimes, yeah, I'll just sit down and write, and whatever is kind of floating around, I'll pull it down. I'll kind of pull it off the mind shelf and put it into a free write or something, a stream of consciousness write, and see what comes out. But of course, also there, you know, I teach workshops, but I also love going to them as well when I have the time. And sometimes a workshop facilitator can show you a poem or give you a prompt or an exercise that can just unlock something brilliant in you that wouldn't have existed before. And I value that so much. You know, there's so many amazing, my peers that are writing alongside me are also, most of them, very, very amazing facilitators as well. So that can be a way that something can arrive with you that wouldn't ordinarily have arrived.
I've got a series of quick fire round questions for you.
And oh, how exciting.
Kind of one word answers, or a couple of words is fine. What was your first job?
Barmaid.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I actually loved it. I loved being a barmaid. It was actually on a seafront bar in Brighton, but I was only 16 at the time, or maybe 15 even, and they found out and sacked me because you obviously have to be over 18 to serve alcohol.
Advice for a younger writer?
Be yourself.
Ah, the authentic voice.
Yeah, don't try and sound like anyone else or write about the things that you should write about. If you want to write about something that you think is not poetic, whether it's poetic or not, the fact that you've thought it and you have an intrigue in it is enough.
Last time you laughed like a crazy cat?
Probably in the middle of the night with my husband when our baby did an enormous fart.
That's a great one. Okay, favourite music artist?
Fontaines DC.
Oh, your inspirational writer, somebody who's really inspired you.
I would say the writer that has had the most influence on me is and has been the most inspiring and encouraging is a poet called Rachel Long, who worked with me on Peach Pig and transformed it, and who made me feel like I could publish that book.
Well, she did a great job. If you were Prime Minister for just a day, what would you do for the arts in the UK?
I would just subsidise them loads and loads more, basically. And I would make it so that all children at school could do creative subjects and they weren't squeezed out of the curriculum. Yeah, I would make sure that everyone had entitlement to a creative output at school. And I would support arts venues more so that they could champion work that might not ordinarily get made.
I love that answer. I love the little phrase, you don't measure your life by the number of breaths you take, but by the number of times your breath is taken away. When was the last time your breath was taken away?
Well, I mean, I gave birth recently, so probably then. It was the most extraordinary moment of my entire life when I heard my son's voice for the first time. That definitely took my breath away.
There's nothing more powerful.
It was extraordinary. I mean, that is genuinely, I don't actually have the words for that. I felt like I'd known him forever. I recognised his voice, even though it was the first time it had ever been heard in the world, you know.
The Roundhouse is turning 20 years old since we reopened this year. What are your hopes? What's your main hope for the future of the next 20 years?
Just that it continues to be this beginning for so many people. It was the beginning for me, and it continues to be a huge part of my life. And I think most people that have had a relationship with the building, they don't just drop in and drop out. You know, it's a sustained relationship, and there's a reason for that. More young people through the doors realising their potential and realising that a career in the arts is possible, can be possible with the right support.
And what does the Roundhouse mean to you?
It feels like a home every time I walk through the door. But again, not to labour the point, but it was the beginning. It was the beginning for me.
And now you begin other people's careers, which is, you nurture them at the early stage of their career and still part of the Roundhouse, which we are joyful about every single day. You have a novel coming out in May.
May the 21st,
called Lack. Can you give us a little headline about it?
Lack is about a young woman. Well, she's in her kind of mid-30s and she's navigating the world as it is now, which is not easy for a young person living in London. I think, you know, we're living in times of, I hate this phrase, cost of living. I feel like that phrase kind of excuses the fact that people can't afford their rent and their groceries and things like that. It feels like a kind of weird piece of language that we've developed just to excuse what should be a completely avoidable reality for so many people. So she's navigating financial pressure, a changing world, social media addiction, climate crisis tapping at the door at every moment. You know, she's dealing with a lot in the contemporary moment, but the novel also flashes back to her childhood, during which she lost her mother and has kind of been grappling with that ever since and hasn't really been able to heal from it. But she's also lacking self-confidence and she's lacking an outlet for her grief. So that sounds really heavy, but I'm told that it's quite amusing in certain parts as well, because yes, she gets into a few scrapes along the way, and yes, I think that's probably enough of a taster, is it?
That's fantastic, and I'm sure people listening to this podcast will be going out and researching your work even more. I don't know if you know it, but you've made me laugh. I've actually had tears in my eyes remembering so many of the things that you've done here, and as I am about to leave the Roundhouse on the 1st of June, it gives me huge amount of joy to be able to speak to you for this time today, but to see your career, to read your work, to see you perform, and to know that you're in this wonderful family and you have motherhood you're celebrating and you've got a new book coming out. It's just fantastic. So Cecilia Knapp, thank you for reading your poems to us. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and for being a wonderful inspiration that you are. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus.